If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
Desperate money never wins, you know, or so it seems. So I think a lot of it is, you know, to get to the level, you're right. Yeah. I mean, you have to have the backing at some point. You have to have some level of success. And a lot of it is just, you know, I mean, I think this recruiting itself is one of the hardest jobs in the whole world. But if you're good at it and you're being successful, elevating, going to different levels or going to retainer shouldn't be that hard.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Jeff Cox.
It's December. January, I started zero. Every year at this job, we started zero. So that's every true. Year I sit here at this desk this time of year thinking, oh, crap, can I do it again? Can I pull it off? You know, I'm always filled with this level of fear of, oh my gosh, I'm starting at zero again. Here we go.
Jeff is the founder of CKR Associates. In this conversation, you'll hear Jeff's journey from aspiring actor to 25-year veteran recruiter.
I had worked all year on stage, which is pretty rare for a stage actor. And I looked at my W-2 and it said $22,000. And I was like, well, that's not going to cut it. So wife and I moved out to LA to try to be movie stars, and that failed miserably.
Jeff specializes in assisting biotech and pharmaceutical companies in building transformative leadership teams.
Mark, I really don't think there's any magic. I think a lot of people are just self-limiting. You know, it's almost a self-fulfilling proposition. Oh, I only place managers. Why? Why do you only place managers? A lot of it's because you're just saying it. So
as a member of the prestigious Pinnacle Society, Jeff is one of the top producing recruiters in the country. But he believes success in this industry is less about the money and more about the people we impact and the life-changing projects that we advance. Jeff, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Mark, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. So we met a couple of times at Pinnacle Society conferences. I'm trying to remember what the first, was it San Diego where we first met, or was it?
Yes, San Diego was the first one.
Okay. All right.
Because I had missed a couple in between there.
I missed a couple too. So I was at San Diego, Savannah, and then recently Atlanta.
Yeah. So San Diego and Atlanta.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
And look, when I first approached, we'll talk about Pinnacle later, because I know that's was something you an achievement you were proud of joining that awesome group of people. When I first approached you on being on the show, you were a bit hesitant. Why is that?
I don't know. I just don't. Sometimes I guess I don't like patting my own back in public. You know, it's one of those things where it's like you're just like, oh, you know, I'm nothing that special. You know, why would you even waste time talking to me? It's, you know, I guess it's kind of imposter syndrome that I suffer with, like a lot of us do.
Exactly. Absolutely. The funny thing is that the majority of people who I interview feel the same way and like have that almost feeling of imposter syndrome. So the very fact that you feel that way means that you're perfect for my show because, you know, I think we all need like humble self-confidence is kind of like the quality that I admire, where someone is successful, but they also, you know, they don't get big-headed about it. So awesome. Listen, we're going to divide this show into four acts. And so let's say act one is joining the family search firm. Act two is starting again as a solo recruiter. Act three is starting to place higher and higher level people and moving to a retain model. And then the final act will be challenges and new beginnings. Does that sound all right for a sort of structure?
Sounds perfect.
Okay, fantastic. So tell me the story then. I know that you were aspiring to become a professional actor.
Yes.
And so how did you end up in this crazy industry?
Well, my father owned a recruiting firm. So I'm not the founder of CKR Associates, but I joined later on. I graduated college in 95, and I'm a classically trained actor. So my objective was go to New York City and be a star. make a lot of money and be a superstar. But along the way, obviously, you know, it's a rough road. So I got an apartment in Weehawken, New Jersey, overlooking the, you know, the river, and I could see New York City from my balcony. And but I never wanted to be a starving artist. So I immediately joined my dad's recruiting firm. And that was basically it. The objective was, hey, have a, you know, a side hustle so I can make some money and not be a starving artist. So I started in 95, and I did it for about a year. I made my first placement in 16 days, which,
wow, that's fast.
Yeah, real fast. It was the record for the group. It was an administrative assistant with a metallurgy company, or so I'm not even sure. Hoganese was the company's name. So I started recruiting, but luckily at the time I started getting some acting gigs. So I was, you know, I'd go out to Cleveland, do a show out in Cleveland, and then come home. And then I was lucky enough to do a couple shows on Broadway. And then, you know, the recruiting kind of, I did it here and there, but really from 95 to about 2001, it was, I kind of phased out because I was doing decently well on stage. And I remember I had worked all year on stage, which is pretty rare for a stage actor. And I looked at my W-2 and it said $22,000. And I was like, well, that's not going to cut it. So wife and I moved out to LA to try to be movie stars, and that failed miserably. And then in April of 2001, I started full-time recruiting again. I was on the West Coast recruiting East Coast hours. So my wife was bartending at the time. So she'd get home at like 2 or 3 in the morning. I'd get to my desk at 5. So we'd kind of cross paths. And, you know, so since 2001, it's been a steady diet of recruiting.
Wow. I didn't know that part of the story, Jeff, that like the first 5 or 6 years, you were actually doing both. You were somehow going back and forth between recruiting and acting. Wow, that's really interesting. And it's crazy that you can, you know, a craft and like acting, which requires so much, you know, training and skill. And even if you're doing it full time, like you're earning 20 some thousand a year, that's crazy. And then what were the kinds of things you were auditioning for in LA?
You know, LA, I never got any traction. I was a lot better off. In hindsight, I should have stayed in New York and been a stage actor and developed from there. I went out, I didn't have good representation in LA. But I was in a sketch comedy group. So we wrote all our own material. We were performing at on Sunset, the Comedy Store, the famous Comedy Store.
Yeah.
So we would perform upstairs, you know, before the headliners would show up.
Wow.
So, you know, but again, it was a lot of fun. It didn't pay, you know, LA wasn't great, but you know, writing your own sketch comedy group and, you know, just it was a lot of fun. And I learned a lot from it as a human.
Absolutely. While we're on the subject, what do you think you learned as a classically trained actor that makes you a better recruiter?
I mean, I think really that's the foundation of why I'm a good recruiter, because you know, the most important thing to do as an actor is to listen and to live in the moment, you know, not to let things get ahead of yourself. So I would say listening is probably, but I guess also the ability, you know, when you play a lot of different characters, you have to be able to jump into other people's skin. You have to be able to figure out what makes other people tick, right? So you play a different character, it's not, you know, what makes this person tick? And really recruiting is talking and listening and trying to figure out what makes someone tick, right? You know, how am I going to overcome an objective? You know, if you're changing a job, you had just mentioned before you moved, right? You recently moved. One of the most stressful things in the world. Job changes are incredibly stressful as well. So, you know, it's one of the hardest things that people do. So my ability, I think, just to meet people where they are, you know, understand where they are and kind of work from there. So acting is really, you know, the cornerstone of my recruiting approach.
All right. So, yeah, that makes total sense. The empathy, being able to see things from other people's points of view and imagine, you know, if you were in their shoes, what would you be thinking, and what would be your motivator? So, yeah, that makes total sense. So, 2001, you decided to just go all in executive search. So, how did things progress from there, Jeff?
You know, I already had the foundation, you know, because I had done it before. So it was stepping in, back in. My dad had an exclusive with GlaxoSmithKline building out their OTC facility in New Jersey. So I first got into it just helping him, you know, facilitate and fill all the jobs. So it was analytical chemists, product development, people in product development, lower level, below manager level. And then, you know, it was, hey, build your own desk. You know, my dad had a recruiting firm of about 10 people. He always liked managing folks and having people around. And I was, you know, I was an asset to him, you know, because obviously I'm trustworthy, I'm his son. And I was, you know, just naturally good at the job. So I just started filling a lot of his jobs while I was building out my own desk. It was difficult though, being in California, because just the time difference, and I like to sleep. You know, and getting up at 5 a.m. has never been one of my fortes. So, you know, just started building out my desk from there and, you know, cold calling into clients, getting my own clients and, you know, being a recruiter, living the lifestyle.
Awesome. And so how long was it that you, were essentially like part of this family farm of 10, because I understand at somewhere along the line you've gone back to being a solo guy, right? So what can you tell that story of, like, well, first of all, building up your own desk and you've been doing this a long time, Jeff. So if you look back over your career, what do you believe have been the critical success factors that have gotten you to not only to have the longevity that you have, but to just consistently improve over time?
I don't think there's any magic, you know, and I think at the end of the day, you always think, you know, when you're going to do a podcast, oh, what can I tell people? You know, what's the magic moment? There is no magic moment. It's just showing up every day and being, you know, like my dad says, you know, we used to say, Dad, I don't know what to do. You know, pick up the phone. That's what you do. Dad, I don't have enough job orders. Pick up the phone. If you work every day, it works out. The critical success, you know, going from, I guess when I moved back from LA and when I got inserted into the family office, the objective is, okay, well, I'm the son. I want to take over the family firm, right? So, you know, now I'm back in the office in Jersey, and I'm helping manage people. I'm running a desk, kind of, he and I got primarily got the most job orders. So people would recruit under us and managing them. And I was just never very good at it because I was so, you know, when I started recruiting, I was his best recruiter. Right. So now all of a sudden I have all these jobs. I have my clients the rainmaker profile, having other recruiters do it. And I am not a good manager of humans because I want to do it myself. You know, so I'm like, I'm letting other people do it. But in actuality, my brain's saying, hey, I'm better. I want to do this. So to no fault of the people that worked for me, really my fault, I was just not a good manager of humans, right? You know, because I don't want to manage. And I finally made the realization that I'm just not a good manager. And I remember one of my dad's old partners came into the office and he whispered to me when I was at my dad's desk. He said, you know, Jeff, go out on your own. It's a heck of a lot easier. And I was like, you know what? I think he's right. You know, I'm not doing them any good. The recruiters who worked for me, I think I can teach someone how to be a recruiter, you know, by osmosis almost. Like if they watched what I did, maybe they would learn. But once I decided, and ultimately I decided because my older brother passed away out of the blue. And it was one of those life-changing moments where I was like, you know what? If I have one life to live, I'm going to start making my decisions and doing what I want to do. And so I told my dad, I was like, Dad, you know, moving to Vermont, which, and I'm shutting down the business. And, you know, honestly, he was a little pissed off at first because he had built something that he was proud of. And here I am, you know, dismantling it. And just, it, you know, one moment I just told him, and, you know, I'm lucky because I got to spend my life working with my father. It's a what a huge blessing to be able to, you know, work with your dad. He taught me so much. I'm only the recruiter I am and person I am because of him. So to make that shift, it was scary, right? Because I was disappointing my dad. But I think ultimately, once I did it, you know, if I went, you know, my billings got larger. And I was just happier. I was in my own element. I didn't, you know, and, you know, like my nephew recruits for me now and he's taking a different path. And I told him, I said, listen, I'm a terrible manager of humans. If you got to figure this out, you're going to have to figure it out on your own or learn from osmosis. So, I was really, you know, proud that I, number one, figured out I wasn't a good manager. And number two, that I just, you know, I did it. I took a shot and just, you know, I'm happier for it.
You've said a couple of times that you felt happier, and that's clearly a signal that it was the correct decision, right? Ultimately, I mean, billing more, obviously, that's one signal that you were going in the right direction. But ultimately, happiness, I mean, what else is life about if it's not to figure out what makes you happy and try and, you know, pursue that? So that makes total sense. One thing I would challenge you on, Jeff, is like you've said multiple times, I'm not a good manager. I believe this is a skill that can be developed. And of course, we all have certain predispositions and natural personalities, which, you know, some people are more natural, kind of find it easier to lead others. But, you know, I think you could become a great manager. But I guess the question is, do you really want to? And that's maybe a more, so I think it's less like I'm not a good manager, more that I don't enjoy managing, I think might be a more accurate way of framing it. What do you think?
I think you might be right. You know, and it's funny because I'm at a point now where my two oldest boys are in college and my middle son, he was like, well, I want to go into finance. Now all of a sudden he's like, Dad, I want to be a recruiter. And I'm thinking, oh. God.
Third generation. That's pretty cool.
But there's a part of me that's thinking, well, okay, well, I know my middle son is he's going to want to build a business. So I'm going to have to change hats. I'm going to have to embrace it. And listen, I'm 52 now. So, you know, if it's being a manager of people that, you know, I have thought, well, maybe I will do that. So you're right. It's, you know, but again, I'm still like a little kid. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a, you know, and it's a great time of year for us to be talking too, because it's December. January, I started zero again. Every year at this job, we started zero. So that's every true. Year I sit here at this desk this time of year thinking, oh crap, can I do it again? Can I pull it off? You know, I'm always filled with this level of fear of, oh my gosh, I'm starting at zero again. Here we go. Long for the ride.
Absolutely. That's funny that you still feel that way after all this time. I think that's natural. All recruiters, like, you know, you like to see the numbers on the board, you know, going up and up. And then whether it's a new month, new quarter, or especially a new year, it's like, you know, am I going to be able to do it again? So, David, I don't know if you know this name. David Ogilvy was the founder of a famous ad agency, Ogilvy and Mather. I don't know if it's Mather or Mather, in New York. He was a Scotsman who moved to New York to seek his fame and fortune. And he became like one of the most famous ad men. You know, the show, about the advertising industry in like the 50s, Mad Men, right?
Yeah.
So he that was his era. And he always said when he sat down to write an ad, he every single time, no matter how many awards they won, how many major accounts they'd onboarded, how many years he'd been doing it, every single time he had this crushing, like fear and self-doubt, like he wasn't going to be able to come up with anything that was good. And he'd have a glass of scotch and he'd get to work. But it was like every single time he sat down to write a new campaign, he felt like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yeah, I can relate to that, but I'm glad I don't have the scotch in my desk because then that could potentially become a problem in recruiting.
That could be.
But it's funny, like, even when I'm like, I have Zoom meetings every week, or, you know, you're meeting with a client and I still get nervous before the meeting starts. It's like, oh my gosh, do I even know what to say? You know, and it goes and you're like, and it's just fine because at the end of the day, you're just being you. So it's not really that complicated.
It's funny. Do you say that? I was thinking about this today. Like, I spend a great proportion of my life feeling nervous. I feel nervous before a podcast recording, before a client meeting, before a, you know, coaching call, before a sales opportunity, before speaking. So I feel like I'm continuously nervous all the time.
We put ourselves through so much stress.
But that's true. But I think it means you just care about doing a good job, right? And you want to do your best, and you know it matters, right? It's important to you, and so, you know, that's where the pressure comes from. At least that's the way I think about it. But I'm glad that you have that feeling as well. I'm not the only one.
No, you're not the only one. We're in the same boat.
So let's just circle back for a second to you joined the family office in New Jersey, team of 10 people. At what point did your dad retire and you took over, or was he still very much working a desk? Or when you had this difficult conversation, like, what was the setup at that point?
We had a recruiting firm of, I think, I would have to think what year it was. So in 2008, we took, you know, obviously 2008 and 2009 were devastating. We took the firm, I think at the highest we were 13, and we shrunk it down to, it was my father, myself, and one other recruiter. And we were just hang on for dear life.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah. And so but at the time, we probably were at about eight recruiters. My cubicle was on one side of the office and dad was on the other side. And I just walked over to him and I told him, I remember, you know, so I guess the year was probably 2014. And he was very much in the business, which is why he was pretty pissed off, because I was just up and leaving, you know, and you know, because I guess, you know, he wanted a couple more years and I was ruining his plan. But as a good dad, you know, we had some knockdown drag-out fights over the years. So
wow.
He was not happy with me. It was a rough conversation, but, you know, he eventually got over it.
Wow. I can only imagine that was difficult for you both and to work through that. On the other hand, as you said, like, that's pretty cool that you got to work with your dad for all that time. My dad's a psychiatrist, so that was never like, you know, you can't, it's not a thing, right, where you can join your dad's practice, at least. Yeah. Well, maybe you could. I do have a friend whose whole family are doctors and they have a clinic together. Like the dad, the daughter, the two sons are all in practice together. But anyway, that wasn't definitely not going to be my path. So I am. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Working with, you know, both of my brothers worked, you know, it was at one, well, I've worked with both of my brothers, but they were both recruiters at some point as well. So, you know, I feel totally blessed that I got to spend so much time with my dad. And, you know, what can I say? It's a blessing. And, you know, was it always easy? No. And mainly, you know, I don't like taking orders from anyone. So he had a delicate task to follow, because I don't listen well.
Yep. Interesting. So how well do you know Catherine Gerald?
I mean, I know her from the meetings. Yes. I know that she and her father, and she eventually purchased her father's firm, right? And she's out on her own.
She's out on her own. I'm not sure what the arrangement was, but I just know that there's a parallel there
family
with
died,
you,
yeah.
Because it was a family. He had an MRI franchise and she grew up inside the family firm. And yeah. So It's interesting. So when you made this announcement, what happened next? Like, as far as the next phase of your business then, Jeff?
It, pretty simple. I packed up and left. We had a condo up in Vermont, on a ski mountain, and we were driving back and forth. And again, I had mentioned my brother passing away, and I had a distinct moment of saying, "Hey, I know I have one life." And then we got this condo, that we would travel to every weekend. And we realized as a family, it just, every weekend we got to Vermont and it was like, oh, I feel so good. I feel so good. So it was basically, you know, hey, let's move to the condo and figure it out from there. So we moved into the condo on the mountain, and I got my little office down in Manchester, and away we went.
Wow, that's cool. So one of the things that you and I had quite a lengthy conversation in preparation for this. And so I know that one of the things that you've accomplished in your career is that as your clients and candidates have gotten older and progressed in their careers, you've kind of grown with them, right? And so you've been able to do more and more higher level positions. Could you speak a little about that? Because initially, I know it was like the, what were the roles? It was like analytical chemists and clinical research associates. And now you're doing like VPs and stuff. So, and some C-level stuff.
Yeah. You know, and it was also one of those things where, you know, I would always say to myself when I was younger, you know, if I was a realtor, I would want to sell million-dollar homes, you know, because I was drawn to the, you know, remember, you know, getting my first $50,000 fee and thinking, you know, this is what I want.
Absolutely.
So it just progressed that, you know, I made a strategic decision, that, hey, I want to play with the big dogs. So it was just a strategic decision that this is what I'm going to start saying into the marketplace. No, I'm sorry, I don't work that level. I only recruit senior director level and above. So it was really just, I forced it. But also a lot of it was, to your point earlier, like I had kind of grown up with these people. So the people I was placing that were chemists became line managers, and they became, some of them became directors. So I could leverage those relationships. But also at the same time, so I had the relationships with these people, but it was also a very strategic decision where I was like, this is what I'm going to do. So I just started putting it out in the marketplace and saying, no, you know, hey, do you want to work this manager? No, thanks. I only do this. And eventually, if you tell enough people what you do, they'll believe you.
Right. Okay. I want to learn more about this, because this is, I think this is going to be super interesting for a lot of people. So there's a conscious strategic decision that, you know, I want to operate at a more senior level. There's multiple reasons why that's a great idea. Number one, you already alluded to, is that the packages are bigger, therefore the fees are bigger. But actually, there's other benefits as well. Like, for one thing, it can be a lot more interesting, right? And for another thing, ironically, it can be easier to place a director or a VP.
Yeah, don't tell people that, though.
an individual contributor, right?
I agree with you 100%. Not only that, Mark, but if you're placing a VP who's sitting right under the C-suite, who are you interacting with? You're interacting with the people who make all the decisions. If you're interacting with the people who make all the decisions and you're placing the leadership, I mean, you become part of the fabric of the company. But you're right. It is so much easier, because you're dealing with individuals who, you know, if you're placing a VP or someone at the C-level, you're dealing with individuals who've made hard choices, who've switched jobs, and you know, they've aggressively managed their career, number one. And also, a lot of these people at the higher levels, it becomes not so much about money anymore, because you've already been successful. You're placing high level people. It doesn't always boil down to dollars and cents, you know, in terms of package. It's, are you doing the right thing at the right time with the right people? Money will work itself out. You know, it's not like, you know, I'll always say to people, it's not like it was when you, oh my gosh, I'm making $100,000 you know, I can buy a nice car. It's, you know, if you're making 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, whatever the individual's total comp package is, if you make $40,000 more or $40,000 less, it doesn't make a hill of beans difference, right? So it really matters. Now you're getting into the recruiting is a lot more fun because it's not just about the money. It's about the job and what are you doing? Is it fun? Are you engaged? Are you learning something? Is the science there? So I enjoy it a lot more.
I want to circle back to this theme of like working with companies where you're become part of the, you know, kind of the fabric of that business and you're involved in something like projects and companies that are doing amazing things. That's pretty cool as well. So let's put a pin in that and come back to that.
Okay.
On the theme of working more and more senior roles, I'd like to just drill down a little bit more about that, because if you think about it, there are a number of different ways to bill $1 million, right? You could do 10 placements of, you know, 100,000. Right, you can make 20 placements of 50,000. Right, you could make, you know, as the fee size gets smaller, it means you have to do more and more, you know, yeah, deals to get that same level. Or you could do one placement of $1 million.
Yeah.
Right, or you know, so I guess it's finding the level that is going to give you the sort of pace that you like in terms of volume of deals and also deal size. And, you know, that is going to allow you to achieve your goals. But in general, it's easier to hit your number with bigger fees than it is with smaller ones, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess the flip side, the downside to that, you know, because most of my deals are going to be over 100,000, right? So, the downside is when you lose a client or you lose a deal or, you know, all of a sudden slips, which is, you know, I'm kind of in a little bit of a flux period now. I mean, it's great, but if you lose one deal or two deals that are 100,000, it hurts a whole heck of a lot.
Oh yeah. It makes a bigger hole in your forecast for sure. So that's true. That is a flip side. So you mentioned a couple of things. One is, like if you work the same market for long enough and you build relationships, then you're going to be connected with more and more senior decision makers. Number two, you do still need to set the intention that you are actually walking away from business. So I want to hear more about that, because that would freak a lot of people out and stop them from pursuing the sort of strategy that you have. So let's talk about that a little bit. What gave you the confidence to sort of say, no, I don't do manager anymore. I only do director and above. And wasn't there like part of you that was like, oh, but that $25,000 fee would come in handy right now?
Honestly, I remember the day distinctly where I was like, I'm never doing this again. It was a really good client that I had helped, that I'd worked with for years. And a new VP of talent, a VP of HR came in, and I had been filling at that time. I'd been filling senior directors or MDs. And she came and was like, oh, well here. And again, nothing against it, but she would only give me administrative assistant levels. And I was like, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. So I said, no. And that was where I just made, I'm prone to making stands. So I just,
okay,
you know, I'll ban places if someone doesn't treat me properly. So, I think it's probably a flaw of mine, but it turned into a strength where I just was like, no, I'm not doing that anymore. Cause I had already had a taste of the higher fees. And I was like, I'm not going backwards. So, and I walked away from, it was at the time, it was one of the best clients that I ever had. And I was just like, you know what?
Isn't there a way to do that diplomatically so that you have at least an opportunity to do their more senior roles? Or had they had you in that box that Jeff Cox only does this level and you weren't ever going to get the other stuff?
Oh, and don't get me wrong, Mark. I did it diplomatically. You know, I was, you know, and honestly, that client eventually came back and gave me, my first C-level job.
Oh, great. Awesome.
You know, so
yeah.
But and the person who took over, who was sticking me in the different box, was one of the biggest providers of retained searches at some point. It did take years, though. I had to go away. The company disappeared for a little bit. My client went away. And eventually, by saying this, putting the same, saying no a lot, they eventually came back and gave me what I wanted. Or I earned what I wanted. You know, it depends on how you look at it.
So making a stand, I think that is a key here, because it is a short-term pain for a longer-term gain, right? And but ultimately, you know, there's an opportunity cost to everything that you do, right? And so, because if you work on one search, means you have less time to work on another search that could potentially be worth two or three times more. So, you know, that's a strategic decision you have to make. Are there any other keys? You said you leveraged your relationships in order to win those higher level positions. Could you say more about that? Like, how, if someone's sitting here listening in, they're mainly placing individual contributors or maybe the occasional manager, and they want to move up the value chain, what advice would you give them in terms of how to do that?
Really, what's the difference? I mean, you're talking to a different audience, right? I think a lot of the times we put mental blocks. Oh, well, I do managers. I can't, these directors, they're so much smarter, so much better. They're just regular old people too, right? We're all doing the same thing. Someone's just got a higher title. Just go fish in a different pond, right? You know, so I really don't think there's any magic. I think a lot of people are just self-limiting. You know, it's almost a self-fulfilling proposition. Oh, I only place managers. Why? Why do you only place managers? A lot of it's because you're just saying it. So I think it's a leap of faith you have to make as an individual. You know, I don't think there's any magic, honestly.
I do think that psychological shift, though, can be enormous, because I think you're right. It mindset is everything, right? There's mindset, then there's strategy, then there's technique or skill, you could say. So mindset, strategy, and skill. And mindset is by far the bigger percentage of your results is based on mindset. But we talked about imposter syndrome at the very beginning of this conversation. And so I can imagine there's a tendency to say, well, I don't think I would be confident speaking to a CEO about a VP level search, right? I would be out of my depth, or I don't have enough experience, or I wouldn't know how to comport myself, or I wouldn't know what questions to ask, or I might not understand the business issues well enough, right? I feel comfortable recruiting these, you know, chemists, but recruiting a VP is way outside my comfort zone. And so I'm just going to stick to what I feel comfortable with, instead of realizing what you're saying is, people are people. Like, whether someone is a VP or a CEO or some other position, ultimately they're another human being. And if you can try and break away from this hierarchical thinking where you assume that a CEO is so much smarter than you, and realize, like, by virtue of me being born on this planet, I am equal to that person, right? And, you know, they are, and then you kind of need to find reasons to reinforce your self-belief. So whether that is looking at how long you've been in a particular industry, or how many people you've placed, or how many people you've interviewed, right? And how much positive feedback you've had from past clients and past candidates, and realizing that in this particular domain of recruiting, let's say within pharmaceutical companies, you have vast experience. And so that should give you the confidence. Like, even if you think of how many people have you interviewed in your career, Jeff?
Gosh, I mean,
thousands and thousands.
I mean,
right?
yeah, a number I don't even know.
Right. So how many people has the CEO interviewed? They probably interviewed a lot, but nowhere near as many as you. So it's like, in this one area, sure, in terms of how to run and grow a pharmaceutical company, you know, clearly they have the experience that you don't have. But in terms of how to find talent, you know, qualify talent, tell an engaging story about a company and about their mission and the opportunity to get the interest of that talent, you know, you and the people listening have far more experience than that CEO in that one area. And so that can give you the confidence to be speaking on a peer-to-peer level with that individual. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. I mean, and I think it goes back, you know, like you said, oh, well, I'm more comfortable recruiting analytical chemists. Well, guess what? When you first started recruiting, you didn't know a darn thing about analytical chemists. HPLC, why don't you, you know, you don't even know what you're talking about. So really, you know, and we all started the same. We all started like, I don't even know what I'm doing. Well, pick up the phone. What do you mean pick up the phone? I don't know what I'm supposed to say. Well, pick up the phone and figure it out, right? It's the same, you know, and the beauty is talk if you want. And I don't think there's anything wrong. In fact, I know tons of people who make a heck of a lot more than I do at manager level or lower level jobs. Doesn't matter. I mean, you can bill $1 million, like you said, a lot of different ways. But if your objective is to recruit higher level folks, if that's what your goal is, and you're afraid to talk to CEOs or chief medical officers or the C-suite, the best way to get over it is just call them. You know, the worst they're going to, you know, number one, they're not going to remember you, right? You're going to have a lot of failed calls, but they're not going to remember you. They get lots of calls. So just start doing it. And the more you do it, you know, the more you realize that we're all humans and, you know, bring value. And just, you know, I would just challenge you, anyone trying to raise the bar is, hey, you got to say no, it's going to be uncomfortable. Accept it, right? It's uncomfortable. Learning something new is uncomfortable. But if you do it, if you commit to it, you know, you can achieve your objective.
I always think that the easiest way to go about this is to start recruiting those people, you know, that you want, say the VPs or the directors, because often that's an easier way. And they're typically people are more receptive to a headhunting call than a sales call, right? So it's easier to get a conversation with someone. And because you're wanting to learn about them and their career aspirations and keep them in mind for any interesting opportunities that may arise that align with what they want to do, then they're patient to answer your questions, you know. And you'll learn tons about that function, that role, that level, the responsibilities, the KPIs, etc. And the irony is, then some of them will become clients as well, just because you build up the relationship. And so, you know, to me, the easiest route, apart from what you said, so start saying no to the lower level positions, but start recruiting at a level above where you are now, and then find an NPC and then take that NPC to market. And guess what? Now you have to talk to the CEO because you're representing a VP, right? So, but, and also the kind of fear of being discovered that you don't know anything, you're not selling the fact that you've already placed a dozen VPs with similar companies. You're selling this particular candidate. And if they're interested in that candidate, then they're going to talk to you. So it's maybe a bit of a shortcut. Jeff, talk to me about the transition to retained and when and why you made that shift.
A lot of it coincides with the move to going, you know, I started a little bit when I was in Jersey with my dad doing retained, but it just got, you know, one of those self-fulfilling prophecies once I started getting it, really moving to Vermont and, you know, saying this is what I do. And why did I do it? Well, because I didn't want to work for free anymore. And I figured, you know what? I deserve it. You know, and again, a lot of it, and do I deserve it? It doesn't, you know, I just felt like, hey, if I'm going to work, if I'm going to provide in my expertise, because I have done a lot to get to where I am, I want to get paid for it. So again, I'm kind of a fly by the seat of your pants kind of guy. I don't have a lot of systems or things that I do. I make strong choices. And that goes back to like being an actor. Was I a great actor? No, but I always made very, very distinct and very strong choices, character choices. And that's just kind of who I am hardwired to be. And again, I don't think retains for everybody. I mean, there's downsides to it because, you know, and especially this year, I think more so than others, I you know, even said to my dad yesterday or the day before, geez, I don't want to do retained anymore. You know, because you get, you know, the market is different now.
Why do you say that? What? Because
My gosh, I have some clients that are like, I'm sending 30 candidates, and they're like, "Oh, we're not finding the right person," because the dynamic is different now, right? And it's painful, you know, because if I'm sending that many candidates, something is wrong. Something is wrong. And but the reality is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether my client is, you know, struggling. I have to fill the job, right? I'm being paid a significant amount of money. Failure is not an option. So it's just, you got to grind it out. And it's been one of those years where I've been on, you know, been grinding it out. So
2024 has been a year of grinding it out for so many recruiters. Some people have told me it's been their toughest year, even, you know, including 2008, 2009. But I wanted to, so grinding it out and doing whatever you need to, you know, totally respect that. But I would challenge the idea that you need to send 30 resumes just because you're retained, because I feel like there's a couple of options there. One being, if you've agreed on the search criteria with a client, they need to see A, B, and C, and you've delivered candidates who meet A, B, and C, and they're rejecting them, then, or they want to change the goalposts and say, well, actually we need D, E, and F, and maybe G, then that's a brand new search, new retainer, and we'll go again, right? Or if you think the client's expectations are unrealistic and they're just unwilling to compromise, the choice you also have is to say, well, look, I've put all the time into this that I'm prepared to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to refund you the initial fee, and, you know, you go and find another solution, and I'm going to move on to another search. And I would feel comfortable doing that. Now, if you're like Korn Ferry or Heidrick, they would just keep the fee anyway, right? Because you have to pay the fee whether they fill the job or not. But I think I wouldn't feel comfortable with that model. I feel like if I'm going to earn the full fee, I need to fill the job. But what's your take on all that?
I'm not giving money back.
Okay. Fair enough.
You know, if I've spent, you know, I've provided an expertise, I you know, there have been situations where I'll forego the final third, where I'll say, you know, I didn't achieve my objective. I'm comfortable not getting that. So I do agree with you on that, but I'm not returning my whole fee.
Fair enough.
You know, I got paid for the time and effort.
It's fair enough. So then wouldn't you say, like in the example search where they're just never satisfied and you feel like you're on the hook because of this retainer, do you not feel you've fulfilled your obligation at that point? You can say, look, we've delivered, you know, we've covered the market, we've spoken to everybody, we've sent you everybody who is conceivably interested in a fit for this role. The search is complete.
I mean, I can trick myself into feeling that way, but I was raised Roman Catholic, so I'm filled with guilt. I just feel guilty. You know, I take this really deadly serious. Like, sure. It's my honor. If I say I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna do it right, and I'm gonna do it properly, and I'm gonna get it buttoned up. So you're right, but there have been times where I've been like, you know, from a business perspective, hey, this is what we've done. You've had more than ample great candidates that you should have pulled the trigger on, and you know, I don't talk to them like this.
I understand,
but I know I'm smart enough to know, hey, you should have hired A, B, and C. You didn't even go to offer stage. So I am comfortable walking away, but the reality is, if you walk away, a lot of the times you're not getting another retainer from that firm. And that's, you know, whether you like it or not, that's, you know, there is a price you pay when you walk away.
Sure. There's always every decision, right? Has,
yep.
You know, there's a cost and there's a benefit, and you have to weigh up which is greater. So coming back to the idea though of making the shift, it sounds like it was a similar thought process, similar mindset to working on more senior roles. It's first of all a decision. This is what I want to go in this direction. I don't like working for free, and you know, I'm worth it. If I'm going to really dedicate my time and expertise to this, you know, then I don't want the client to change their mind at the last minute and go, oh, never mind, we filled the job internally, or, you know, the things that we all know can happen. So you made that decision. And is that, did you start saying no to the contingent stuff, or what was the, like, was it overnight you just switched overnight, or was it an evolution?
It was, I think that one of the things that gave me the ability to make strong choices, it just from a housekeeping perspective, right, from a life perspective, is I kept my household. Yeah, I didn't have to, I've set myself up where my expenses were never too high. So, you know, I think that's, you know, I made a strategic choice to live within my means. And when I made these choices, I was like, okay, you've got enough runway where you can actually do it. It's foolish to do if you don't set yourself up properly. Right? You have to have some financial sense to make that bold choice.
So this is, I'm really glad you mentioned this, because in order to have true walkaway power, you have to have an alternative that you're equally happy with, right? Otherwise, you're just bluffing, and clients can sense if you're bluffing, right? But if you're serious and you have walkaway power, you have to be comfortable with the alternative. You're equally happy. So the alternative being, I don't get that placement fee. Because they only will do it contingent, but I've got enough runway that I'm not going to starve in the next month. I'm still going to pay my mortgage. And so I'm okay with that. There's a book called Getting to Yes by Fisher and Urey. It's a negotiation book. And they talk about developing a BATNA, best alternative to negotiated agreement. So what is your, like, you obviously want to negotiate a retained search. If they say no, what's your best alternative? And if you don't have one, then you're kind of like, well, okay, I guess I'll do it contingent. But if you have an alternative, then you're good, and you can walk away. And the irony of walk away power, though, is when you're that strong and that confident, it usually works. And then you don't have to walk away, and then you do get the retainer. So it's this weird mindset of walk away power where you're prepared to walk away, which means that you get what you want.
Yeah. But Mark, I mean, I'm sure you remember back when you started recruiting, when you were so desperate to make a deal. It's like, oh my gosh, I've got this one candidate. I pray to God they're going to get the job. They never get the job.
Right.
I mean, you know, desperate money never wins. You know, or so it seems. So I think a lot of it is, you know, to get to the level, you're right. Yeah. I mean, you have to have the backing at some point. You have to have some level of success. And a lot of it is just, you know, I mean, I think this recruiting itself is one of the hardest jobs in the whole world. But if you're good at it, and you're being successful, elevating, going to different levels or going to retainer shouldn't be that hard. If you've got the, you know, save some money to do it before you make the big choice.
So really it's about making a decision and making strong choices. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. And sometimes people will say to me, Mark, I don't think I can sell retain because, you know, my clients might not like it, et cetera. And I say to them, listen, if you went to work for a retained search firm and that's all they did, and you were not allowed to take a mandate on a contingent basis, do you think you'd figure it out? And they'd be like, well, yeah, I guess you'd have to. Exactly. So pretend as if, because you're the boss, it means that, you know, you're letting yourself off the hook, but pretend as if you work at a retained executive search firm and there is no other choice. That's all we do. How would you behave and act and think differently? And it's a mental trick.
Yeah, because even you said it, like the person says, well, my clients wouldn't like that. Well, but you know, and it's the same thing. I remember when I went from, you know, I would always work at 25%, right? You know, back when I was recruiting, and then someone from another firm we hired, and they were like, oh, we get all these jobs at 30%. I was like, well, my clients wouldn't. Wait a second. She did it. She's not even that good of a recruiter. So I started asking for 30%. And guess what? Lo and behold, you get it. I mean, right. But you're certainly not going to get 30% if you don't ask. But if you start asking, you know, and go to the Pinnacle meeting, you know, I sat there as, and I, you know, you think, oh, good me, I get 30% on base salary. And then you talk to Jed Meyer or someone else and they're like, I get 33% on the whole darn package. And I go, boom. You know, that, so, you know,
right.
Mine 2025, I'm really excited about, like I said earlier, like, you know, you start January, you start from nothing. I even tell my kids, oh, you know, make strong choices, but I'm stuck in the same boat as the person that's saying, oh, well, I can't go do retainers. You know, my clients aren't going to like that. I'm in that same boat now. I'm in the same self-limiting mindset that I was in 7 years ago or 8 years ago or 10 years ago. I'm stuck at this level that I'm at now, and I have to make a strategic choice. What do I want to be when I grow up? What's the next step? Am I content? Are my clients only going to take, you know, just do what I do now? Or am I going to make another strong choice and go to the next level? Or am I going to stay where I am? And I don't know. I'm still kind of scared to figure out what I'm going to be. I don't know.
Are you comfortable talking a little bit about you share with me offline, you're in the midst of a big reset. Can you say more about what that means and what you're thinking going into 2025?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm comfortable saying anything. I think the pharmaceutical and biotech industry has had a rough year. And there's this balancing act that I'm going through in my brain. Do I go back to contingency? When times are tough, like what do I do? You know, I'm on the phone with my dad every day. Dad, I don't know what to do. You know, what, do I do this? Do I do that? And he's like, no, son, hold on. So now I am, you know, it's one of those things where it is kind of a reset. Now, did I have a terrible year? No. I mean, I was under where I would have anticipated to be. It's been slow the last couple months. And I think if I'm being truthful, a lot of it is my own doing, right? You get too, because at a certain point in your career, or a certain point in my career, I became too comfortable.
Ah,
you know, right. And it is funny. It goes back to acting. I stopped being as specific as I should be. I started, you know, because the market was the way the market was. It didn't require, I had so many jobs, it didn't much matter. I could fill a job, you know, $100,000 fee in 9 phone calls. I got the job filled. It's not that market now. And I have found that I'm not doing my job as well as I should. So it's now, for me, it's a time to get back to the basics. And I think that's what 2025 is. It's get back to doing the job properly, you know, and I fault myself because I should have known this, but sometimes you don't see it. But really, like, sitting here now, it's just getting back to the basics. So I'm excited. And that's exciting to me. It's like the realization is I got to go back to the basics. I got to start hammering out the phone calls. And it's exciting.
I'm glad you're excited. And I think very often we need to have this conversation with ourselves where we say, go back to the basics. That seems to be, you know, anytime you're overwhelmed, stuck, plateaued, in a slump, you know, whatever's going on, very often the solution is go back to the basics, right? And, you know, get that beginner's mindset again and go back to what were the things that you did every day and every week and every month that made you successful in the first place. And let's go back to those basics. And nobody is too experienced or too, you know, senior or too big of a biller to go back to the fundamentals. I think, you know, what you said is apt for all of us. Jeff, is there anything that we hadn't talked about yet that you wanted to explore today?
No. I've had fun just chatting with you.
Yeah, me too. That was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Happy holidays, happy new year, and I'll see you at the next conference.
I'll see you then. Thanks, Jeff. Have a great 2025.